Good afternoon, everyone. We are going to go ahead and convene the meeting. We do apologize that we are starting late, and we are apologetic that we do not have all of the members here. We're just coming out of caucuses. However, we do have a lot of individuals here to share their stories. We want to make sure that everyone gets an opportunity to have it officially recorded for the tape. So you will be having more members come in shortly, but we do want to get going if that is okay. I think we're going to start with, we got the chairwoman. Can I have you come up, please? And just to remind everyone, because there is a long list of interested parties wanting to share their thoughts today, and we do not have longer than 2:15, we are going to be very diligent with the amount of time given, so please keep your remarks briefer than 2 minutes. Good afternoon. If you can give your name officially for the tape, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Irma Visner, and I'm the tribal chairwoman of the Whiters Tribe located in northern Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I'm here today to follow up on presentations that Whiters has given to this committee in the past. I want to thank the committee for supporting us as a top priority, one of the top priorities in the House Human Services Subcommittee. Whiters has done due diligence in a project for a youth facility for tribal youth who are in the juvenile correctional system now. A majority, or I would say 90% of the youth in the correctional system are there because of chemical and alcohol abuse problems. So I would like to also inform the committee that we have $2 million in Governor Pawlenty's budget that will go a ways towards funding the $6 million that we are requesting. We are still working in cooperation with the Department of Human Services, the State Department, and we ask for the committee's continued support for this greatly needed service for our tribal youth. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Appreciate that. Are there any questions for my fellow comrades over there?
No.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know if we should be asking questions because they've all made their presentations, and I think we're here to listen to their return. So
thank you, Representative Erickson. Come on down. You're the next man up.
Madam Chair, members of the division, I'm Mark McAfee, legislative representative of AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 workers throughout Minnesota, including state, county, municipal, school district, university, hospital, and long-term care workers, some of whom are from nonprofit organizations. Appreciate the opportunity to be here and comment on the governor's health and human service budget recommendations. First thing we'll say is after months of talking about health care reform, and many of the people in the room here, as well as certainly many members of this committee, were involved on talk about health care reform. The governor proposes to take health care access funds back to the general revenue and use them to help balance the budget. Is anyone really surprised at that? Done it before? Done it again? Governor talks of health care reform, but appears to be walking away from it with this proposal. Others will speak to you, I'm sure, about the thousands of people, especially children, that may be denied access to Minnesota care as a result of these proposals, and we share those concerns. The governor has raised the drawbridge and says no more may enter the program. There's a couple of specific budget items we call your attention to that talk about operational budget reductions in the Department of Health, also in Department of Human Services. And we're interested in that because some of those members and central office or whatever may be ours. And I call to your attention because I don't know if it occurred. I wasn't here when the presentation was made in the House here. But over on the Senate side, I know there were some pointed questions asked whether the assistant commissioner said there was an estimated 39 full-time equivalents that would be cut. You know, usually an estimate is 40 or 50. It's pretty precise. And he then stated that the department would take some time to determine, you know, where that impact would be. I think that this division certainly needs to know before you make those decisions exactly what services would be cut or eliminated if that goes forward. We're opposed. There's a provision that would require counties to reimburse the state for overspending DD waiver 2004-2005. It affects some counties like St. Louis. That decision was made. We're opposed to reopening that. We're concerned about the proposal to delay rebasing of inpatient hospital rates till January 2010. I think you'll hear others representing the hospitals talking a little more in detail about that. You will hear from others about long-term care and really freezing nursing home rates, getting rid of rebasing. We had some freezes earlier, came forward with the bill in the last session. This would reverse some of that. We share concern with that, and we are, AFSCME is a member of the Senior Workers for Equality Coalition. You'll be hearing from those folks. There was a hearing in the Policy Committee, which many of you sat through, I think it was on February 11th. We talked about target case management, what was going on with the proposed federal rule, which has now been implemented. We also have concerns about child support enforcement. There are some bills. I think you'll hear one of them on child support enforcement next Tuesday. We hope you'll fully hear out these bills, which ask for, again, some one-time money in these areas and to be watching what happens on the federal level as you consider implications of those choices. Just a couple more points. We've been hit with the H-bomb. Once again, Health and Human Services and higher ed, the H programs, and we could say healthcare access is sort of ground zero. They've been hit with the highest reductions in the governor's supplemental budget. And what about solutions? I was told we need to come up with some solutions. I'll start out by saying that I'm going to take a slight amount of license here because I'm unaware that you yet have any budget targets for this committee. But I would say, first of all, that I would encourage you to look at, for example, Department of Human Services. Take a look at what they're spending on contracted or outsourced services. We just learned of some cancellation regarding Health Match. I don't have before me a current or updated list, but I think aside from the items that are indicated in the governor's budget, take a look at where we're at with contracted services. That's an option. I think we feel the no new taxes approach isn't working well. If we are going to avoid or minimize cuts to programs and services, still recovering from those recent cuts, and avoid using the healthcare access fund, we need other options. And for our part, we think it's fine to use a portion of the rainy day fund, the budget reserve. But for the remainder, we really do need to be open to the possibility of revenues. And we haven't been reluctant to say that we ought to look at closure of tax loopholes, use of progressive income tax. We certainly oppose reducing the sales tax. And I think if we're really going to have health care reform. We have to, even though we know perhaps how the governor feels on all these issues, we need to be open on where we at with a provider tax or tobacco or whatever else. We need to exhaust those options. You know, look carefully again over where all the money is spent, DHS, other agencies. So far, I'm unaware that any revenue is absolutely taken off the table, at least in the legislature. Consider all those things, and
I'm sorry to wrap you up.
Okay.
We have to get wrapped up. We have 25 people to get through in an hour.
Well, I am finished. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry about that. Thank you very much. Representative Broad.
Madam Chair, and just for the testifier, I think as we talk about the provider tax and the tobacco tax, we need to put on the table at the same time that those are the most regressive taxes. The only more regressive tax on the books is the gambling tax. So what you're supporting are very regressive taxes within the structure of the system. And Madam Chair, I did want to put on the record too, you know, I think it's fair for us to criticize and question the budget, but I'm very clear that the governor is committed to health care reform, and so to suggest that he's walked away from any opportunities for health care reform just because of an initial shot at a budget just doesn't seem to be either accurate or true. And so I hope that we'll kind of stick to the budget items and stick to the facts as we go forward, because, you know, we are going to be hearing on Monday a very significant health care reform piece that, while there's significant concerns over it, it is a very large step in the direction of what both the governor and the Representative Huntley, who's carrying the bill, are deeming to be health care reform. So there is not any walking away from health care reform, and I hope that we'll continue to have that debate as we go forward.
Representative Broad well said, while we cannot determine and dictate what individuals from the community are going to be coming up to testify in front of us as their feelings as it relates to the proposed budget cuts, we'll have plenty of time when we wrestle with what comes out of this committee next week, including the health care bill that you were just talking about. We'll have a lot of opportunity to partisan banter and everything else from there, but right now we're just try to get through these folks as quickly as we can. But well taken. Can we get the three county folks up? Okay. Good afternoon, and if you could state your name officially for the tape, and please adhere to my over-briefing request to be brief.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. My name is John Berg. I'm a county commissioner from Watlin County, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I will offer some general perspectives and then turn to others to provide more specifics. Counties appreciate that the governor budget contains huge direct cuts to the counties. This is especially appreciated because counties are still trying to recover from the significant cuts made in 2003. In addition, as I am sure you know, we are facing significant reductions at the federal level in Medicaid targeted case management and other fund sources. Our testimony today is intended to reflect on how the governor's budget recommendations specifically impact counties. But we would also like to encourage the committee to focus on how the governor's recommendations impact our entire system, because counties play a role in the provision of such broad array of publicly funded human services. We are in a unique position compared to many other testifiers in this, in that we see firsthand how funding changes in one program area have a ripple effect across the entire system and ultimately impact our ability to effectively and efficiently serve our clients. Thus, we would like to focus part of our testimony on pointing out some of these system-wide ripples effects that will likely result from the governor's budget recommendation. As a local elected official, I am all too familiar with the fact that funding cuts need to be considered in any budget shortfall. However, we must be honest about how sometimes reducing investments in certain services only serves to increase future costs for our state and local governments. While this accounting strategy may appear to balance the budget this biennium, often the reality is that we are only shifting the budget shortfall from one biennium to the next. Balancing the budget in this way is not only disingenuous, but it's truly harmful to the well-being of the clients we have the responsibility to serve. In addition, publicly funded health and social service programs are countercyclical. That is, demand rises when the economy is down. This means there will be more demand for these services in a recession, not less, as people lose jobs and health insurance. Most of the savings in this budget come from the refinancing of the Health Care Access Fund and TANF to the General Fund, and funding transitional Minnesota care from the Health Care Access Fund. Depleting these funds is likely to result in higher overall costs for health care and social services because we will have more people receiving acute care and more people on welfare. We need to ask questions as a society. Are we concerned about the long term or only the short term? Now, I'd like to turn it over to Jim Behrens, Director of the Adult and Family Services in Olmsted County, and Mary Welke, Director of the Public Health in Olmsted County, who will focus on how the governor's budget statistically impacts county public health and social service departments.
Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Wellick. I'm the Public Health Director from Olmsted County. I'm representing the local Public Health Association of Minnesota. The recently announced budget shortfall places you as policymakers in a difficult position. The services provided by state and local government are critical to our community's health, safety, and progress. LPH, local public health, statewide, has broad responsibilities, including disease prevention and control, emergency preparedness, assuring access to health care, building healthy communities, and protecting against environmental hazards. Local health departments are still recovering from the significant impact of the 2003-2004 cuts that we experienced. For example, in my department, we continue to rebuild some of the maternal and child health progress that we lost at that time, and we've not been able to reestablish some of the disease surveillance efforts that we had going at that point and have lost capacity to do. In my department, in Olmsted County, in the last 5 to 6 years, we've seen close to $1 million in shifts from state and federal money. So it's not only the state money that's impacting us, but as Commissioner Berg said, we also are experiencing ongoing shifts from federal reductions in funding. Those shifts have been to our property taxes. This year, in Olmsted County, 23% of our current levy is a result of those federal and state shifts. The effectiveness of local public health interventions is dependent on sustainability and the high-quality collaboration we have with schools, law enforcement, social services, and other community partners. Without stable funding, our capacity to deliver against the outcomes that you expect is diminished, and it's diminished considerably. When the economy suffers and when reductions occur in funding and support for community organizations serving high-risk and at-risk persons, public health services are in greater demand. I think that's evident in every community in the WIC program. If you look statewide, the WIC caseloads have increased consistently over the last 5 to 6 years. In my community, 11% increases at a minimum each year for the last 5 or 6 years. Our infrastructure in public health is built on skilled and competent staff and effective information systems. We rely on you to help us retain and keep that resource in place. Ultimately, the result is healthy people, reduced burden of disease, and safe communities across our state. Counties and the state need to work closely together in determining ways to contain costs that will have the least impact on the vulnerable and will not lessen our considerable progress in improving health outcomes. Jim will provide some input from the standpoint of social services.
Good afternoon, sir. Please identify yourself.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Jim Behrens. I'm the Director of Adult Services in Olmsted County, and we'll speak briefly on several provisions in the governor's budget on behalf of Minnesota Association of County Social Services Administrators. First off, I'd like, in terms of the targeted case management issues and the federal cuts that we're facing, we'd like the committee to continue to keep in mind that we are continuing to deal with the loss of those revenues, and any compliance with the Deficit Reduction Act that's included in this, we hope that there would be some flexibility in that as we work with the federal government on potential moratorium and other ways of dealing with those revenue shortfalls. On the transfer of the $2.5 million of the CD fund to the general fund, we do understand that's simply a balance transfer, and it's typically, from a historical perspective, what is done in those situations, and that we understand it will not have an impact on the availability of services for individuals. But we have been working with the state for several years to try to rectify a calculation process that is outdated, that ends up with some of the counties spending more money on the CD fund services, and this would have been an opportunity to use some of those funds to try to help deal with that issue. With regard to the proposal for state-operated services to withhold the federal funds from counties if they're more than 90 days overdue with their bills, that does seem reasonable and fair on the surface. We would like the committee to keep in mind that there are some issues, we believe, that are not in the direct control of the counties that do impact this. One of those are outdated, non-automated billing systems. Another is the delivery of the bills from the state. A third might simply be a disagreement among counties about who is actually responsible to pay. If we can work those kinds of issues out, we believe that we are comfortable with this proposed penalty as it is there. However, we do not support the proposal that counties that have been forgiven for the overpayment in the developmental disabilities waiver spending be required to pay that bill at this point. It's my understanding that those counties involved already have letters of forgiveness from the Department of Human Services from legislative action last year. I also am aware that in Olmsted County, those budgets are managed very carefully, in fact, to within 0.5%, so we can really maximize the resources needed there, and we continue to have long waiting lists in our county in particular. It's over 150 people that have been screened and eligible for those services that we don't have resources for. Also, with regard to other home and community-based waivers, we do understand that the proposal in the governor's budget is a slowing of growth in those waivers, and that we would still have access to about 80% of the projected growth. I want to put that into personal context. In Olmsted County alone, that lack of or reduction in growth ends up being two individuals each month that we won't be able to serve if we use our historical service rate as a guide for that. I hope that those points outline some of the concerns of the county, and any reduction in county-operated funds for services would also have an impact on those that we serve. We ask that the legislature and the governor continue to work with the counties to move forward in these decisions. And if you have any questions, we'll be grateful.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, you said that you would be seeking flexibility with the DEFRA mandates that you have. Could you give an example of what flexibility you might be looking for?
We currently at this point have the potential for a moratorium of several months, and as we work out whether or not those specific definitions around targeted case management, for instance, and some of the changes that would occur in relocation services might be an example. As we work those out with the federal government, we want flexibility at the state level in terms of compliance as it relates to the budget that's projected.
Does that do it for you, Representative Dean? Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for driving up today and being patient. Mr. Nelson and Ms. Henry, if we can get you guys up. Good afternoon, Mr. Nelson. I feel like I just seen you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good evening with you last night, Mr. Nelson.
And members of the division, I am Bruce Nelson with ARM. We represent providers who provides support to people with disabilities and ICFMR and the various waivers. And our members, about 150 of them, employ about 30,000 direct support professionals. And with me today is one of those outstanding direct support professionals, Rita Mechanic Hastings, who's doing this for some 34 years. Yes.
Slide this over just a little bit, just to make sure. There's paper and stuff. I want to make sure that it's on the tape well.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. First off, we at ARM do understand you have some daunting decisions to make and an incredible challenge ahead of you. At the same time, we find that the budget that was proposed by the administration to be stunning in several ways. First off, we're in a time of an economic downturn. And that's a time when people are losing jobs and people need health care more, when people are stretched, and that's the very time when they need a safety net. And to go into my second point, to take out, I understand it's $398 million in transfers from the Healthcare Access Fund, which is intended for an entirely different purpose for a different population, for their health care and their very important health care needs, combined with cuts. The way we look at it, this budget takes about 56% of its solution out of Health and Human Services and the very services and programs that people need in these very difficult times. In particular, Rita next to me is one of the many people who would suffer from no COLA should the governor's budget be enacted, and found it ironic to say the least that while the budget would eliminate the COLA for 30,000 people working in our area, and you combine that with nursing homes and other areas, about 100,000 people who wouldn't even get a modest 2% increase, that at the same time the budget proposes to reduce sales tax by 0.125%. In other words, we're asking Rita and 100,000 some other people to take the burden of the deficit and a solution to pay for a tax break for everybody else. I'm a baseball fan, and the season openers on March 31st, and I really hope that there aren't committee meetings that night because I want to be at the game. But let's imagine that the game this year is the private sector, the direct support professionals who, like Rita, who work all across the state. And that the other team are people who do exactly the same work, the direct support professionals who work in state-operated facilities, state employees. Well, last year the score in the first inning was 3-2. State employees got a 3% increase, Rita and the private sector 2. Now, this budget's adopted to go into the second inning. Still another three runs for the state employees doing the same work, and 0. So we have a score now after 2 innings of 6-2. And I ask you to consider that as you're looking ahead.
Mr. Wilson, I'm sorry. I need you to fully wrap it up. I'm being the evil chairwoman today. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure we get through folks.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that we're concerned as providers, but we're mostly concerned about the impact on people with disabilities, and the direct support professionals. And if you would bear with me a moment, Rita has some very compelling things to say.
Thanks.
On behalf of a lot of folks in this room.
I appreciate that. Members, for our official, the meeting is officially here. We actually have enough members here. Decorum is present. Thank you. Thank you. It's called to order, Representative Sotwalk. Rita, I didn't catch your last name. If you can identify yourself for the case.
Sure. My name is Rita Mechanic Hastings, and I work for...
I'm sorry, ma'am. Can you spell that?
Sure. M-C-A-N-I-N-C-H-Hastings. H-A-S-T-I-N-G-S. I work for Dakota Communities Incorporated. I've worked for them for 27 years. But I started with the state of Minnesota in 1966, and trading off Bruce's baseball analogy here, if I would have had a manager at that point, they would have said, don't let yourself be traded to the private sector, because if you do, you're going to lose 40% of your wages, and you're probably never going to be able to retire because you don't really have a retirement program. And on top of that, your insurance is going to be about 10 times as high as you would pay if you stayed with the state of Minnesota. So what we find is that, yes, we're doing exactly the same job, we're paid 40% less. And many of us now are reaching the point where we're looking at retirement. So we're looking to recruit young people who have the same sort of passion to come into this field. And when I say passion, I don't want you to also assume that anybody who works as a direct support is a special person. We do not come with halos. We did not wake up in the middle of the night because we were given a dream that this is the field we're supposed to come into. This is not a vocation. This is a job. This is a career. It's a career we've chosen. It's a career that many of us have stayed in for a long period of time because we really like what we do and we're really good at it. But that does not mean that our mortgage companies and the utility companies understand that somehow we're special people and then therefore we're supposed to get a special rate, because we don't get a special rate. We pay the same as everybody else does. What we don't get is the same raise and when we come to the Capitol year after year. I don't understand how you can say that a state worker who does the same job that I do is worth more than my work is. Because most of you are going to see me for 2 minutes today, then you're not going to see me again. You have no idea what kind of work I do. The fact that I stayed in this field for 34 years and the people that I work for appreciate me, that's what I take home every day. But what I don't take home is enough money to make my bills most of the time. So I don't quite understand why we have to be up here every year. I know you guys have a really hard time figuring out how you're going to get the money to pay for all the things that the state requests as representatives to pay for. I'm a single parent. When I needed to make more money to raise my child, I worked more hours, because I had to increase the amount of money that I made. Now, it seems to me that the state of Minnesota is trying to be like a single parent or a family that wants to be able to spend more money without bringing in more money. And that, to me, just doesn't make any sense. So, as a taxpayer, I'm okay with you raising my taxes. Not a ton, but a little bit here. We could all spread it around, because I want to be able to retire someday. And I want to be able to see people hired into this field. And what am I supposed to say to them? We want you to have a college degree, but we're going to pay you $10 an hour. If you're a single person, you're going to pay $240 a month for insurance. You have a family of three people, now it's $900 a month. You're going to pay that out of your $10 or $11 an hour. You want a raise? We think you're a really good employee. You're going to have to wait for the state to give it to you. They may or may not give it to you. Not based on your work ability or what kind of an employee you are, but based on some criteria that you have no control over. Okay. So that's kind of where we stand at this point. And like I said, I know you guys have a hard job to do, but if you can't figure out how to increase our coal every year, then the state needs to figure out how you are going to fill the holes that are in nonprofits where we can't hire people.
I want to thank you for your testimony. Appreciate that. And I know firsthand of the work that you're doing. For those of you that think I'm being short, you're welcome to submit letters. I am going to be a little bit more pushy, otherwise I'm going to let Representative Howe
chair, and it will get worse. And so I'm just letting you guys know that up front. We will be getting through this list by 2:15, whether we like it or not, and we do have someone to make sure that we have it if you don't start catching clues. So I do apologize. It's just the way that it works, but we want to make sure that we get as much information recorded officially on the tape. And you are free to lobby us, email us, send us letters, do the things that you usually do to make sure that we hear you, but we just want to make sure we get as many voices recorded. Ms. Henry.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good afternoon. My name is Ann Henry, and I'm with the Minnesota Disability Law Center Legal Aid Society. We represent people with significant disabilities across Minnesota. You're going to get a one-page list with five areas. Obviously, 2 minutes isn't time to talk about them, and you'll hear in specific detail from others. So I just want to make 2 points. One, these cuts to disability services that I've listed there and others you'll hear about are on top of very severe cuts to the disability community that began actually in 2002 when the waiver for people with developmental disabilities, the new resources, were cut in half. And that waiver was frozen virtually for 4 years. We now have a waiting list of 4,900 people. The TAC and TBI waivers, which are, have enrollment caps reestablished here, were also had caps for 4 years. These cuts have not really been restored and now more. It is simply corrosive and harsh and shouldn't be done to people with disabilities, to their families, and to their caregivers. The second point is that the state dollar savings on numerous of the budget pages only tell half the story in terms of the impact on people with disabilities. That's because we are turning our backs on federal Medicaid match. For instance, the service value of the first two items on my memo, the CADI and TBI cut and the MINDO cut, if you add up the service value of that to people with disabilities who need supports to stay in the community over 3 years, it's $68 million. Half of that is federal money. Now, that money is not stuffed under a mattress or in any cookie jar. What is that money used for? It's used to hire people. It's used to build ramps, to widen doorways, to provide services and support so people can work, people with disabilities can be employed. That's what the money is used for. That money goes around in the economy, and it has an economic effect, besides the very personal, serious effect on people with disabilities. Another example is the community services COLA. The savings for the state, $33 million. But we are saying no to $27 million in federal money that also could go to the lowest paid workers in our healthcare system, those personal care assistants, the staff in many, many programs. Now, I think that that money, which they will certainly have to spend, you've just heard stories about that, will have far more of an economic impact than the eighth of a cent sales tax cut. So thank you very much, and we will work hard with you as the process continues.
Ms. Henry, if we can get Ms. Tachita and Ms. Worcester up, and then if we could have some folks on deck just so we can save some time while you're coming to testify next, that'd be helpful too. Good afternoon. If you can identify yourself for the tape, we greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Anna Tachman from UCARE. I'm actually going to sit in for Gita Worcester today. Thank you for this opportunity to talk about Minnesota disability health options and to talk a little bit about how some of the governor's budget recommendations might impact this important program. As many of you know, this is a partnership between Access Healthcare, CHS, and UCARE. This program currently serves about 1,000 people that have physical disabilities and are qualified for medical assistance and or Medicare. This is a program that is currently offered in the seven county metro area. MINDO is a nationally recognized program, and it is one of very few programs in the country that fully integrates Medicaid and Medicare and waivers service dollars and services. It is a patient-centered program that implements many of the attributes that have been discussed in the healthcare reform discussions this past fall, summer, and what the legislature is currently considering in healthcare reform. MINDO incorporates care coordination, the healthcare home model, care across the continuum, and chronic disease management. These are all the major themes that I've heard about and have heard discussed in healthcare reform. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Rachel Pita and Deanne Rice, who work at Access Healthcare, and they will give our perspective on the governor's budget recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Rachel Pita with Access Healthcare, and the Governor Pawlenty's budget proposal includes a recommendation to remove home and community-based or waiver services from the MINDO program for people who joined the program after July of 2008. Instead of a single health care home with integrated acute and waiver dollars, new enrollees would have a separate case manager at the county level to manage waiver services. Eliminating access to this integrated funding would disrupt the positive preventive care and health maintenance activities and further fragment care for individuals with disabilities. We ask that you reject the governor's MINDO proposal and continue to allow for integrated care coordination and further evaluation of this MINDO model. Because I know we're short on time, there is this handout that has the Access logo on it, and on the back, it does speak to some of the cost savings you see with some of the particular clinical initiatives we have because of our specialization and experience with people with disabilities. And then I'm going to let Deanne Rice, one of our care coordinators, speak to some other issues.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm here to encourage you to keep MINDO whole. The proposed changes to the MINDO program would negatively affect the members and the nursing care we provide them. I am a care coordinator, public health nurse, who has worked for the past 5 years with Access. Prior to that, I worked with Caddy Cash and TBI with Hennepin County. I have over 30 years of nursing experience, in addition to my decade of experience working with people with disabilities. My other experiences include intensive care nursing, emergency room nursing, occupational health nursing, sexual assault nurse clinician, and international care working with refugees. I feel fortunate to have found a position that allows me to assess and coordinate care for our members across the entire continuum of care, through their hospital stays, nursing facility stays, and back into the community. Having the authority to initiate and monitor home and community-based services or waiver services is a key component of that continuum. I have a few concerns. Number one, duplication and redundancy. Access care coordinators assess and work with members to address the holistic needs and goals of the members we serve. If waiver services were removed, our members who need waivers would have another completely separate assessment with another entity. Would that allow us to be nimble and fulfill the mission for our MINDO clients, which includes the right care at the right time, at the right place, and be cost effective? Would I be spending precious care coordination time trying to get a hold of county subcontractors rather than with the member to meet their health and safety needs and goals? I have a real life example. Sherry, she's 23, has a diagnosis of cerebral palsy, unspecified psychosis, conversion disorder, seizure disorder, obesity, and asthma. Sherry has multiple hospitalizations because of her problems with her AV shunt and her baclofen pump malfunction. Her coping skills were affected by her situation, and she angered easily. When angry, she went inward and became suicidal. In an 18-month period of time, she had over 5 hospitalizations for mental health and multiple emergency room visits. Behavioral services, a waivered service, were initiated by our Access team. These professionals worked with her assisted living staff, creating and implementing a behavior plan to help Sherry. In the last 18 months, she has not had any hospitalizations. She is now planning on attending school, has started a regular exercise program, and is losing weight. Would she have benefited by having another agency such as the state manager long-term care benefits? In fact, one of the recommendations of the behavior professional was to decrease the number of people who were involved with her to increase the consistency of interaction and care. A second concern is how do we improve the quality and effectiveness of these waivered services? Removing waivered services from the MINDO program would take away energy from reaching one of our goals outlined in the CAN-DO initiative, which is improving the quality of care. Access intimately and holistically knows our members and their needs and goals. If we were not in the position of initiating, monitoring, and evaluating waiver service, it would greatly impact how we could affect change with our providers and their services. The third one concern that I have is that this change in access to waivers would not be in alignment with the goals to simplify and integrate services for people with disabilities. We currently serve the 7-county metro area and have found unique processes in each county on how intake for waivers is initiated and how decisions about needs and services are made. MINDA was initiated by the state to provide integrated services, and with this proposed change, these gains would be lost. The 7 different systems and decision trees brings exponentially increased complexity to serving our members. In my experience, one of the weaknesses of the county system can be the often cumbersome and conflicting administrative and funding structures with inequities between the counties. I have an example. Access assisted in relocating a young woman, Susie, from Courage Center. She had been assaulted by a boyfriend, which resulted in a traumatic brain injury. She had a history of methamphetamine abuse and was the mother of 2 small children under the age of 5. She moved from one county to another as she became more independent. Waivered services were initiated, which assisted her in learning independent living skills, parenting skills, and modifying her home to allow her to function safely. She was able to gain back custody and is now caring for her children. She currently is no longer in need of waiver services, but what a great example of how integration of care works to make lives of families and individuals with disabilities better. Because we could surround her with the care coordination and services she needed at the right time, in the right place, and in the right setting, she is now drug-free and once again independent and a full-time mother to her children. I appreciate the challenge we have as Minnesotans to deal with this budget deficit, but I strongly feel that removing waivered services from MINDO does not serve people with disabilities, some of our most vulnerable citizens, well. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Pete Larson with the ARC of Minnesota and co-chair of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities. And along with me today are 2 of the members of ARC, Don Bortson and Bernadette Hughes, and they will be testifying first. And Madam Chair, I first want to let you know that even though we're all eligible for AARP, we're very quick testifiers.
Okay. Mr. Larson, I thank you for that.
Don?
All right, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Don Bortson, a parent of 6 children. Dave, who's our youngest at 31 years of age, has severe developmental disabilities. He lives in a medical assistance waiver-funded foster group home in Ramsey County. Please do not eliminate the 2% cost of living adjustment, the COLA, promised to the long-term care who work with people with disabilities in foster group homes and day training and rehabilitation services. If they do not get the 2% COLA, I'm worried they will be humiliated and expect not to be able to provide for their family's needs as the cost of living goes up, but their salary does not. I'd like to help you appreciate more what staff does for the people with disabilities by describing some of the things they do for our son. Dave needs significant support from his staff for several reasons. Staff needs to dress, wash, toilet, and change him when he has urine or VM accidents. At the same time, they need to control his and their behavior very carefully because he gets upset and has tantrums easily. They also have to be careful to cut up his food in small pieces before he eats because he chokes easily. Staff also has to get up with him during the night when he has bladder spasms. During these spasms, he crawls and walks frantically around the house for 10 to 30 minutes before he finally voids, after which he goes back to sleep. He has fallen and injured him during some of these spasms, so staff has learned to stay close to him and to catch him before he falls. He has spasms in his legs that also cause him to fall. Dave does try to reward staff by being happy most of the time. and laughs easily for them when they demonstrate their slapstick humor. He also likes to make others laugh by making fun of their shoes or clothes or making funny noises. He has a limited verbal and sign language vocabulary, which staff has learned to determine what food or activities he wants. Dave keeps staff very busy because he likes a lot of attention, just like most people. Since he has cerebral palsy in his legs, staff tries to help him maintain his ability to walk by using physical therapy, putting on his leg braces, and taking him for walks in the community a couple of times a day to stretch his ligaments. Going for walks in the community is an experience in itself that can be very embarrassing for some staff. He gets so excited before he enters a mall or a store, he tries to say hi repeatedly to those he sees. He says hi so loud that it sounds like he's screaming for the first couple of minutes before he calms down and gets in the store. Thank you for listening to the story about our son's staff. I hope it has helped you realize that their type of job is very difficult and important. It requires excellent people who care about Dave's quality of life. Thank you for considering my request not to eliminate the 2% cost of living adjustment COLA promised to the long-term care staff. I also want to thank you for having provided excellent services for the many people with disabilities in Minnesota. My wife and I are more than willing to pay an income tax increase so that all the long-term care facility staff can receive their 2% salary and first they were promised. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. Ms. Hughes.
I'm Bernie Hughes, and I thank you for the opportunity to talk to this committee. I am mother of 8 children, 2 of whom are severely disabled. I have kept those 2 children at home with me, and I'm proud of the care I've given them. My son is 43 and my daughter is 34. Originally, we thought they had cerebral palsy. It has turned out that they have a progressive neurological condition, and they've lost almost all function. They both have lost their voice. They are on feeding tubes and are total care. I care for them, and if I had kept the scorecard with the state, I think my debits would far out increase the state's credits. I'm not here to try and balance the books. I just don't want my debits to get up and your credits to keep going down. I've fought for years for services for them in education and in transportation and in adapted housing grants, and I seem to see a system of where we go forward 1 or 2 steps and back a little bit. And I'm tired of it. I'm exhausted from having to be such a constant advocate. I think my children and other disabled people are the most vulnerable people, citizens of the state of Minnesota. And the state is only willing to treat them as if they are the least important. The PCA program needs great revision, but that's where part of the COLA goes. And it's very hard to get good workers. They're very poorly trained. Their absentee rate, their turnover rate is high. They get very few, they get no mileage. They get a very small medical stipend if they work full-time. If they work part-time, they don't get it. I have this past year had 5 different workers for my son. One of the workers got sick in the fall last September, and I could not get a replacement. I took care of my son for 3 weeks myself. You will see on the picture on the handout that my husband got a brain infection 9 years ago. He spent 2 years in hospitals and 7 years in a nursing home. She died last spring. So I am alone in this battle, and if I don't get better help, my children will be placed. My daughter is on a waiver. I've gone through 2 appeals to the waiver city system in Ramsey County for more hours, and I've been denied, and then I went to the appeal, and the referee denied it because the county doesn't have the money. Because they have a program of where you average the amount of money available according to the number of people, and it is not based on the needs of the client. I don't feel I can go to 2 PCAs because of the unreliability of the PCA program. So please don't make my help quit get other jobs that pay more, leave me, or you will have to place both my children and me someplace, and you're not saving money.
Thank you, Ms. Hughes. Mm-hmm. Your testimony.
Madam Chair, we heard the stories from Don and from Bernie, very dramatic as far as the services that they need, the dependence that they have on staff. So as co-chair of the Consortium with Citizens Disabilities, first of all, I agree with many of the testifiers before us on specific issues. I know that we were asked in this committee to identify resources of income, and I just want to share with the group that as representing the ARC of Minnesota and our consortium, I've been to Washington, D.C. on donated dollars. No state or federal dollars were involved, working with Senator Coleman's office twice now in the last 2 weeks to advocate for the TCM moratorium and the a universal moratorium on six different rules that CMS is trying to implement that will cost the states millions of dollars. So we hope that that will happen. The Pioneer Press on Sunday had an editorial on the governor's supplemental budget. It called that one of the aspects of the governor's proposal was a provider cut. As we heard today, this is not a provider cut. It's a cut to the lowest paid health care workers in the system. We cannot allow this to happen. We need to make sure that persons with disabilities are supported in their community. Thank you for the time to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. The next several individuals, if you can come on up, and it's easier to cut off individuals that come to our committee on a regular basis. And so you might as well start shrinking your words down to a minute because I don't have a problem doing you guys. You guys are real easy. Thank you if you can identify yourself. Welcome to the committee.
Not a sure.
Nothing personal, but there's still 20 folks that we got to get up in the next 30 minutes. And so start shrinking in your words. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
My name is Jeff Lindu. I'm a pharmacist. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Pharmacists Association, the Minnesota Retailers, Minnesota Grocers Association, National Association of Chain Drug Stores. I want to thank you for the opportunity. I'm going to be presenting a bunch of numbers here. You do have a handout. I apologize. It's the one that says this is a Senate committee, one of the downfalls of using cut and paste on my intro. The governor's budget proposes a change in reimbursement for pharmacies from AWP minus 12% plus a 365 fee to AWP minus 14. I'm sure that's very difficult to digest for you. It's tough enough for us in pharmacy. With that, I want to make it very clear. It's very important to understand that a $3.65 dispensing fee, even the Department of Human Services, everyone acknowledges that that in itself is not an adequate dispensing fee, and that the pharmacy must gain a certain portion of their reimbursement from the difference between what they actually pay for a drug and the cost calculation that's in the formula. And I'll refer back to this a time or two. I'd also like to state Minnesota Medicaid, and I'm going to be presenting numbers. I work for Thrifty White Drug. We operate 47 pharmacies in the state of Minnesota, and the numbers that I'm presenting today are from our actual experience in filling prescriptions for the state of Minnesota. Minnesota Medicaid is already our lowest paying third-party program in which we participate. A couple of years ago, the department did a survey on the cost of dispensing in Minnesota. It's a couple years old, but at that time they found the cost to dispense in a prescription in Minnesota to be about $9.59. That does not include any allowance for profit, and it does not include the 2% wholesale drug tax that pharmacies pay. Several years ago, pharmacy community proposed co-pays as a cost-saving measure for the state of Minnesota. For pharmacies, that backfired. Last year, our company wrote off $88,000 in unpaid copays on Medicaid prescriptions. That amounts to 4% of our reimbursement for Medicaid prescriptions in the state of Minnesota. I want to thank you. The past several years, you have voted down proposed fee decreases for pharmacy in the state of Minnesota. However, I think it's important that you understand that this AWP minus 12, AWP minus 14 cost calculation really only applies to brand name prescriptions. The department has the independent authority to set the cost reimbursement portion of this formula themselves for generic medications. And over the past several years, they have been very aggressively reducing the cost calculation on generics for the Medicaid program in Minnesota, to the point that over the past 4 years, the dollars that our company is paid to fill a generic prescription have dropped by 24%. That's not inflation adjusted. That's not relative to increases in cost. That is strictly the dollars paid to fill a prescription, a generic prescription 4 years ago, the dollars paid today to fill a generic prescription. We are down 24%.
Mr. Lindo, I'm sorry. I'm going to need you to wrap up because you do have a handout. Okay. Some of your final.
That's nearly $3 below the $9.59 cost of dispensing. Overall, that translates for our company to a 7% reduction in reimbursement. When we add the 4% loss in copays, over the last 4 years, pharmacy in Minnesota has had an 11% reduction in reimbursement. During the same period of time, a 22% increase in salaries, and the administrative costs at DHS have increased by 46%. This cut would result in another 13% reduction, giving us a total of 24%. I think it's very important to note there are 149 communities in the state of Minnesota with one pharmacy. Many of those communities, the pharmacy is the only health care provider in the community. If you serve a rural district, many of your constituents are depending on that pharmacy for their services. Pharmacy simply, that this change is going to result in many of those pharmacies, the worst business decision that they could make is probably to continue to accept Medicaid prescriptions. Probably the second worst decision that they could make would be to not accept them.
Thank you, Mr. Lindo. Chair Huntley.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Mr. Lindo, the governor's people have said that this rate cut will simply get the state payments closer to what the market payment rate is. Do you have any comment on that?
I said earlier that in our experience, currently, Minnesota Medicaid is already the lowest payer that we have. On the brand side, they are competitive. It's the generic side, and 70% of the prescriptions that we fill for the state Medicaid program are generic. On the generic side, they are dramatically lower than most private insurance plans and Medicare D plans. Dramatically lower.
Thank you.
Does that answer it, Representative Huntley?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thanks for the afternoon. My name is Carol Spector, and I'm the Advocacy and Legislative Affairs Director for Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to testify today. I can try and be very short and sweet because my testimony is very simple, that the governor's proposed budget almost entirely undoes the gains made for children's health coverage that this body worked for last year at the leadership of Representative Chief and Representative Huntley in this committee. To get a little more into the detail, the transitional Medicaid program, medical assistance program, and would cut funding for health care for 20,000 kids, the outreach for thousands more. Both of these provisions do address some access barriers in our system. I do want to highlight that in terms of the outreach, currently 75% of uninsured children are believed eligible for public programs. And this outreach money would have been reaching a lot of them. We also, these gains were significant progress as Minnesota has been moving backwards in trends for children. I just want to highlight in the economic hard times, which several testifiers before have highlighted, that 152,000 children are living in poverty. That is an increase of over one-third since 2000. And our increase in extreme poverty, half of the poverty line, has doubled during that same period. The number of uninsured children has also increased. We're at 85,000 now.
And so cutting the gains from last year would just be a significant step backwards, especially in light of the health care reform discussions that have been happening since the end of last session. My final point is I just want to say that CEF Minnesota does not support taking money out of the Health Care Access Fund to plug the general fund budget holes when it is cutting, especially when it's cutting provisions like expanding children's health care, which is the appropriate use for the Health Care Access Fund dollars. So with that, I understand the enormity of the task before the legislature this session, but we urge the legislature to continue the leadership it showed last session and continue to cover children and the future of our state.
I loved it. Thank you. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I am not Greg Klukert. I'm Julie Gruner with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. I will really try to be brief. The first issue that I'd like to highlight, and you've heard this before, is the use of the Health Care Access Fund to balance the budget. The proposal takes $250 million out of the Health Care Access Fund and transfers it to the general fund. The proposal also refinances a number of programs using the access fund, and it's estimated that the total cost of the Health Care Access Fund is nearly $400 million. The Health Care Access Fund was created to fund Minnesota care and should not be used to backfill a general fund deficit. The expansion of the withhold on health plans will have a significant impact on the health plans. For one plan alone, this would represent nearly a $20 million delay. The expansion of the withhold would be a $20 million delay for just one health plan. This is more than the margins that the plans receive for public programs. Over the last 10 years, the margins that the plans have received have been less than 1% of public programs. In addition, the withhold changes include delaying payments into future bienniums, which could bring into question the actuarial soundness of the rate. You heard from Ms. Spector, I think, very well the difficulty in the reduction of outreach funding. We think this is a very serious problem. And we're disappointed in, of course, the repeal of a number of the eligibility expansions set to become effective over the next year. It's imperative that the momentum generated this past summer and fall around health care reform, covering the uninsured and making health care more affordable, continue to move forward. We hope the legislature will seek alternative ways to resolve the budget deficit rather than looking to the Health Care Access Fund and shape public health care programs for citizens. The governor's budget is disproportionately heavy on health and human service programs. It's nearly 56% of the cut. It's just not an even distribution. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. And I'm going to let you guys come up, and then actually I'm going to jump around to make sure, because we do have some folks that have come from other areas. And Dr. George, yeah, you're going to be up on deck. I'm sorry. And if we can get the woman from the Alzheimer's Association, White Bear Lake Care Center next, and Welfare Rights Committee next. And I'm still going to hold everybody to that minute thing. So thank you.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Mary Braddock, and I am a pediatrician at Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, where I also serve as the Director of Child Health Policy. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association and its 145 members, I want to thank you for this opportunity to express our strong concerns over the administration's health and human services budget recommendations. Before highlighting the three components of the budget proposal that the hospital community is most concerned about, I think that it's important to mention that we are very pleased that the governor's budget recommendations did not include yet another round of rateable reductions in the Medicaid program. Regrettably, the three previous imposed inpatient hospital rate reductions are still in place. The budget cuts made in 2002, 2003, and 2005, when added together, total an 11.5% cut to inpatient hospital payment rates. Because these cuts are cumulative, there is a loss of approximately $293 million in payment reductions for the 08 and 09 biennium. Because of federal matching funds, protecting medical assistance is a very important issue for the hospital community. At Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, 37.4% of our revenue comes from medical assistance, and this number has been increasing each year since the year 2000. Any reductions in the Medicaid program disproportionately affect hospitals such as Children's that serve the greatest number of low-income patients and also take care of many of the sickest patients in the state. Our three specific concerns within the governor's budget recommendations are, number one, the delay of inpatient hospital rebasement. When serving medical assistance patients, hospitals are currently paid at 2002 cost. This is determined by DHS, minus that 11.5%. Rebasing, which is currently scheduled to occur in 2009, would bring the hospital cost payment schedule up to 2004, minus 11.5%. A delay in this rebasing would mean that hospitals would have payment rates based on costs from 6 years ago, minus 11.5%. For hospitals such as Children's, where our services change constantly based on rapidly advancing treatments and technologies, this is especially problematic. For Minneapolis and St. Paul Children's Hospitals and Clinics, this delay of rebasing will cost us $13.6 million. The impact to hospitals statewide is calculated to be $76.7 million when the federal match is figured in. And this hits particularly hard those hospitals that care for the largest proportion of patients on medical assistance, such as St. Mary's and St. Luke's in Duluth, Bemidji, Regents Hospital, Hennepin County Medical Center, Fairview University Medical Center, and Gillette Children's Specialty Healthcare. Our second concern has to do with the elimination of inpatient hospital supplemental payments, disproportionate share hospital payments, also known as DSH. And this has been a very frustrating issue for the hospital community for the last 5 years. In 2003, the federal government increased by 16% the amount of DSH money available for low DSH states such as Minnesota. It was the intent of the federal government that these dollars be used for hospital payments. Current Minnesota law has a distribution formula that allocates a higher percentage of DSH dollars to those hospitals that serve the most Medicaid patients. So far, these DSH dollars have not been leveraged as the legislature intended, and we have been extremely frustrated by that.
Ms. Braddock, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get you to wrap up.
We continue to believe that it was not the federal government's intent to use this money for other health and human service expenditures, but to date, hospitals have not seen any of the DSH dollars. We believe that the Department of Human Services has been intent on taking this money long before there was a budget crisis, and we hope that for the sake of this community, this committee, and its difficult budget deliberations, that the department will finally leverage this federal money, which would produce an additional $58 million. That's all I have to
Thank
say.
Thank you, ma'am. Please identify and try to be as brief as you can.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Paul Katz. I'm here today on behalf of Children's Hospitals and Clinics to discuss the impact of this year's budget proposal on Children's Hospitals and Clinics. It has a disproportionate impact on this hospital as it did in 2003 and 2005. I hope to take a moment to take a moment to look at this document that we handed out to you that we provided committee members. It has a number of items in it that I'd like to discuss very briefly. Number one, first of all, the numbers speak for themselves. The children serve more children covered under medical assistance and prepaid medical assistance than any provider in the state. Medicaid is children's largest single source of revenue and accounted for over 37% of children's revenue in 2007. You can balance that against an average acute care adult hospital, which averages about 12% of revenues from that same pot of money. Last year, our disproportionate share payments totaled $18.5 million. Last year, this committee and the legislature allocated additional DSH money, which this proposal would eliminate. Even after rebasing kicks in, which it would not under this budget proposal, Children's 2007 costs would exceed Medicaid reimbursement by almost $13 million. Finally, absent the new DSH dollars allocated in 2007, Children's costs, not their charges, but costs, are projected to exceed Medicaid reimbursement by over $23 million in 2010. That's just 2 years away. If you add the impact of the rebasing delay, that total jumps to $36 million in total. We've said before in this committee that Children's is disproportionately impacted by some of the budget decisions that are made in this committee. We ask you to carefully consider these budget decisions, and that the, including the disproportionate share payments, rebasing, and let's hope not, but reimbursement rates, and consider those, just how those decisions disproportionately impact children's hospitals. Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. Dr. George.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Shepweister. I'm a family physician from St. Cloud, and I've spoken before this committee several times over the last year. I'm speaking today as president-elect of the Minnesota Medical Association. Appreciate the opportunity that you're providing for me to speak here. We recognize as an organization the challenge you have in trying to balance the large budget deficits, but would like you to consider a few things in your deliberations. For the current biennium, just under 30% of the state's budget is being spent on health and human services. That's a large number, but is reflective of this state's values and commitments, we believe, to protecting the health of all Minnesotans and to providing health care to the most vulnerable populations. But while we spend 30% on health and human services, you'll notice that the governor's recommendation is to utilize 56% of the budget at the expense of these services. In addition, once again, the proposal is to raise the health care access fund to the tune, as you know, to close to $400 million over the next few years. Remember, this fund was established and dedicated for the purpose of expanding access and coverage for the otherwise uninsured Minnesotans, and now the plan is to use a third of the, to try to balance a third of the budget deficit through this sick tax. By stealing from the health care access fund, this also undermines the state's obligation to those Minnesotans who are currently eligible for but not yet receiving Minnesota care. It doesn't make sense given all the work over the last 8 months in developing health care reform proposals that would ensure coverage for all Minnesotans, given this recommendation. Not surprisingly, physicians of Minnesota are outraged. This proposal is an affront to all the hardworking healthcare professionals of the state and to their patients on whose back this cost is ultimately borne. And for me personally, I kind of feel like it's a slap in the face as well. As you probably know, the very existence of the sick tax has been a very contentious issue for physicians. I personally have spent a lot of my personal capital in trying to convince them of the benefits of the healthcare access fund to improving access to care, but to once again steal the money to balance the budget rather than spreading that more fairly across that pain more fairly across the entire population has a bad impact on my personal credibility. Over the past 5 years, the physicians and patients of this state have watched as more than $400 million has been siphoned from this unique and dedicated fund to shore up the general fund. We think enough is enough. Despite its temptation, I strongly urge you to oppose using this access fund to balance the budget and to maintain its integrity. When the fund is used as it's intended, the physicians in Minnesota are prepared to do their part, but we cannot sit by and let this fund continue to be raided for non-healthcare purposes. The health of the Minnesotans is too important.
Thank you, Dr. Stewart. Sorry to have rushed you in, just for the record, for those, we don't like to use the word steal, transfer, switch, any other words, but using steal, we try not to use that word too often. Can we get welfare rights? I thank you for your testimony. Welfare rights. And if we can, if we are going to try to get through a couple more individuals, are there any other individuals that was listed on this list that is not from the metro area? And if you could send a note about that, because then I will make sure that you get up next. Thank you. Please be brief, you know, as brief as we can be.
Hi, my name is Kim Hosmer. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. And we're being presented this year with the same old story that took place in 2003. Governor Pawlenty is presenting the people of Minnesota with the same old sorry response. The state is in a budget deficit. The governor's solution? Cut from the poor, cut from the disabled, cut from the sick and elderly. Who has to pay for this deficit? Once again, the Governor Pawlenty says those of us with the least ability to pay.
will be the ones to pay for this deficit. Once again, he's balancing the state budget on the backs of the poor and working Minnesotans. Pawlenty's budget is a proposal filled with theft. It steals money from TANFs for poor families, it steals money from health care, access funds for people who can't afford health care. And that's just as it started. TANF dollars are federal dollars that are supposed to be spent on welfare for children and their families in poverty. It is illegal to steal TANF dollars to supplant general grant funds or general fund spending. It is immoral to steal money from the survival programs for low-income and working families to balance a budget deficit. The fact remains, poor and working families did not create this budget deficit. We should not be the ones to pay. Not once does Governor Pawlenty talk about cutting from those who have so much money that it is disgusting to the rest of us. Not once does he talk about the billions in permanent tax breaks given to the richest in this state. Replacing state general fund dollars with TANF funds is nothing but a shell game designed to take money from Minnesota's poorest families, mothers, and children in order to protect tax breaks for the wealthiest Minnesotans. Those of us being squeezed from every side have the solution to this budget deficit. We tell Pawlenty, we have the fix. Tax the rich. This state and country are in a recession. A recession means that we do not need fewer programs for unemployed workers and poor families. It means we need more. It means more and more will fill the ranks of the unemployment lines and those in poverty. It means more and more will join the lines of people waiting at the welfare offices. Once that job is yanked from us and that unemployment insurance runs out, all we have left is to go down and apply for welfare. Because as we know, there are just simply not enough jobs to go around.
The difference this time around...
Please identify yourself, ma'am.
This is Lyndon Galboy. I'm with the Welfare Rights Committee. The difference this time around is Pawlenty is only the governor. He cannot make all these cuts or steal all these funds unless elected lawmakers in this capital allow him to. If he is allowed to get away with this devious scheme, it will be because he was not stopped. It is the moral responsibility of all conscientious legislators to stop these proposals dead in their tracks, and we are counting on you to do this. There are bills, House Files 3616 and 3618, that use the TANF money for TANF families. Instead of schemes to steal from the poor, we are still dealing with the devastating cuts from 2003. Families on welfare saw the monthly survival grant cut by as much as one-third. There has not been a cost of living increase, i.e. a grant increase, in MFIP for 22 years. To top all that off, Pawlenty and many others want us to work for free. What do you think that a pool of free labor does to an already depressed labor market? House Files 3616 and 18 will fix these things. I want to close by saying the reality is Governor Pawlenty and others who like to bash the poor think it's easy to beat up on poor women and children. They think they can win political points by criminalizing us and then slashing our programs. It is up to the conscientious legislators in this capital to stop this ugly game that is going on. Silence against these attacks is not an option. The time is long overdue. Our families have suffered too long and too much. It's time to stop. Don't balance the budget on our backs. Don't steal TANF funds and make the rich pay for the budget deficit, not poor and working Minnesotans.
Thank you. Recess minute. Ms. Anderson, if you can come up, and before you testify, members, we just have some house cleaning. Representative Otremba, do you mind moving the March 11th minutes for us?
So moved.
Thank you. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Members, I really should say to the audience again, on behalf of Chair Huntley and the committee before you, we do apologize that we started late. We do extend an apology that we are not going to make it through all the testifiers today. There will be a long-term hearing with some testimony and also some MFIP testimony next week. I do encourage you again to send your thoughts in writing if you weren't able to share today. This is going to be our last testifier. We do need to get to Health and Human Service Policy after this so we can get going there. Again, for those that have come down to the first time, lobbyists, activists that have been here a long time. They know this is how we do it. I do extend a special apology to you because I don't want you to think that we as your legislators are just trying to be short and quick. It's one of the things that happens often when we get down to deadlines, and oftentimes we have to cut testimony short to make sure that we can get through as many individuals as possible. And as you can see, sometimes it's hard to get them going and getting thoughts out because it's such a difficult decision that people are going to be facing in the next couple weeks, in the next couple months as we move forward. But we do appreciate it. Ms. Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to try to be brief. My name is Lori Anderson. I'm from White Bear Lake Care Center, and I'm going to try to be brief, but I'm speaking from the heart, so it's really hard to be rushed. I've been a nursing assistant for 28 years, and I'm a failure. And let me explain why. First of all, I feel like a failure because this is just the first time I've been here giving testimony, talking about problems in long-term care. My big fear is that when I'm 80 years old, they'll be rolling me in here in my wheelchair talking about the same problems. This isn't my career, but it's starting to feel like one. Every time I come here, I hope you'll get the message that I will finally reach someone enough to care, someone enough to fix these problems. Perhaps you're thinking that, oh, here's that group again, whining about their problems, whining for money. I don't think of it as whining, though. I think of it as moaning. Because in my mind, I hear the moaning of the people that I take care of and work with. For you have condemned us to what amounts to a slavery and bondage. We are slaves to a system that is working and is failing. We are in bondage to a system that doesn't want to pay their employees a living wage. My residents are held in hostage to the goodwill of the state of Minnesota, whether or not they choose to improve their quality of life by giving better increases to nursing homes so that they may receive better care. Although it may sound a little bit melodramatic, I sit here today feeling like Moses standing before Pharaoh saying, let my people go. I feel like a failure because I just don't know how to reach people enough to make them understand that they care enough to start putting money into our long-term care system. If I sound angry, it's because I am. If I sound frustrated, it's because I am. Time after time, people tell me they couldn't do my job and that they couldn't be paid enough to do my job. Yet no one wants to put their money where their mouth is. No one is willing to take a stand. And if there are people willing to do my job, then doesn't it make sense to pay the ones in the industry enough money to make a living?
Yeah.
I do love my job, and I do it gladly, as do many of my coworkers. Yet how can they get by working full-time yet can't pay their bills, or buy health insurance, or feed their children? This past session, you passed the Packing House Bill of Rights. And it's about time our government and society realize how dangerous the packing houses are to work in, mainly due to line speed. But sadly enough, I can sit here today and talk about the line speed as it pertains to my nursing home. It's just as dangerous. Injuries and mistakes like to recur. Yet the big difference is that I'm working with fragile human beings. We can't recruit or retain good employees because, quite frankly, people can't make it with these wages. And to top it off, work with the frustration of not having enough time to do your job and do it well enough to your satisfaction. Many either go to another career or go work for a hospital. Hospitals are paying between $4 to $10 more an hour. And how can we compete with that? Those of us working in long-term care are the very ones taking care of your grandparents, your parents, your friends, or the ones simply forgotten. The vulnerable, the sick, and the fragile. We don't expect to get rich. We know it's not that kind of job. It's a career of love, but unfortunately you can't support your family on just love. Many of my coworkers pay their rent and then have to go to the food shelf. They can't afford health insurance, so they go to emergency room. They can't make ends meet. They quit. No one in this state should work a skilled job full-time and yet have to go to the food shelf. We can't take care of our people, yet the system doesn't want to pay us enough so we can take care of ourselves. If I don't do my job well and take care of my residents properly, I get written up and perhaps turned to the state health department. Yet, I feel that the state hasn't taken care of my residents well enough. So I ask you this, who do I have to talk to turn into the state? Yes, I may be a failure. Perhaps I didn't speak out strongly enough in the past. Perhaps there was more I could have done. But I'm not the only failure here. Our state has failed to fix these problems. They have failed the nursing home workers and its residents. In essence, they have failed us all. I would like to close with this. I implore all of you to set aside your political differences, make this a top priority, support us in long-term care instead of picking away at us. Help me stay in a job I love. Help my coworkers stay in a job they love. Help my residents live a life with dignity and respect and the best quality of care we can give them, the quality they deserve. I'm just going to end with this. One last thought. The future of long-term care is in your hands now. But in a blink of an eye, some misfortune may befall you, and tomorrow your future will be in my hands. Thank you for your time, Ms. Anderson. Audience, please. Representative Loeffler, do you still have something that you'd like to quickly say?
Quickly. Well, Madam Chair, all I was going to say, when you encourage people to provide additional information in writing, to also encourage them to give feedback to the governor on the impacts as well. Sometimes people forget that step.
Representative Loeffler, well taken, and please include solutions, because as we get caught up into our individual silos on a regular basis, and we have a tough decision ahead of us, and it's not that some folks aren't going to get cut. There will be individuals. So if you have solutions that have not been shared, please give that to Chair Huntley and Ms. Holcomb. Members, please put your papers on top of the folder so our pages can just grab it and deal with it later so we can get policy going. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.